Coming up in this episode, the challenges facing U.S. Central Command, ISIS.
They have booby traps. They have what we call vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices. I don't know if you ever remember watching the A-Team, but some of their vehicles, they take a car, the chassis, and they put... It looks just like something out of a bad television show where they put armor all over it and they put a suicide bomber in there.
Then there's Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, their niche is exporting terrorist plots. From Yemen, they hatch these plans, and then through the internet and other means, they get them out.
Afghanistan.
It is, unfortunately, the forgotten conflict going on.
Colonel John Thomas, spokesman for U.S. Central Command, lays out the situation in all of those areas and many more as a part of U.S. Central Command's areas of responsibility. And to quote the Navy SEAL phrase that's etched above the grinder in the basic underwater demolition SEAL compound, the only easy day was yesterday. That seems to especially apply to the U.S. Central Command looking at the road ahead for them. We'll discuss it with Colonel Thomas. Coming up on this edition of Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
From WTOP in Washington, D.C., this is Target USA. Russia
could render huge harm to this country.
North Korea's secret missile
capable of reaching the whole of the United States.
Dangerous terrorist.
DC is repeatedly mentioned as someplace they would like to seek an attack.
Cyber criminals.
Decryption successful.
America has a target on its back. And on this program, we investigate the threats, the people behind them, the agencies fighting them, and the impact on you. This is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
I'm J.J. Green. Responsible for U.S. military activity in 20 countries, U.S. Central Command is up against it right now. It's faced with multiple difficult generational challenges. The Taliban is surging in Afghanistan. ISIS, so-called caliphate, is crumbling in Iraq and Syria. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula continues to make deceptively clever and elusive bombs while engaged in a brutal fight to take over Yemen. CENTCOM spokesman Colonel John Thomas paints a stark picture for Target USA of the incredibly complex and dangerous challenges facing U.S. Central Command. Colonel Thomas, there is a lot going on in your area of responsibility. So would you begin by just giving us an update on where you are right now with all of your with all of your responsibilities?
With all of the 20 nations that United States Central Command is responsible for, our primary focus right now is on defeating ISIS. You may have heard that in Western Mosul, they're very close to defeat and the Iraqi army has them surrounded. But the ISIS terrorist blew up a 800-year-old mosque as a desperation move, I guess, to deny it from the Muslim world and from the people of Mosul because they're about to lose. So we're focused on destroying, defeating ISIS in Mosul and then across the border into Syria, where they are also in the city of Raqqa. And they've been there for building up for more than 2 years, almost 3 years, and that's our central focus. There are a lot of other things going on, and you may have heard in the news about unmanned area vehicles that we've shot down, or an Su-22 Syrian regime aircraft.
Yeah.
So there's a number of issues going on almost daily, mm-hmm. and we're trying to maintain the focus against ISIS and maintain that momentum against them.
Let me get to a few of those things, and I'll ask you about them individually. But first, since you mentioned the situation regarding the Grand al-Nuri Mosque, so you are certain, obviously, that it was they that blew it up and they did it intentionally, because what they said was that someone else did it, the U.S. did it. And we, of course, got word from your team that that wasn't the case. But are they now admitting that they did it, to your knowledge?
Well, it's laughable that they would say we did it. We're working in close contact with the Iraqi security forces, and we understand the cultural and religious significance of that particular mosque, which is where they chose to declare their caliphate more than 2.5 years ago. It was not our intention to do any harm to that or to the people in that area. We confirmed ourselves. We went back and we were taking, there were airstrikes in the vicinity earlier in the day that day, not at the time of or anywhere specifically near that mosque. We don't know precisely how they arranged the detonation, but they leveled it and they took out the famous leaning minaret as well as the mosque. It's clear. I think the Iraqi security forces were right on it immediately, and we did our due diligence. We went back to check just in case we were striking in that area and maybe something had gone wrong. But absolutely, that's not the case.
Colonel, what do you believe then? Is there a real reason for doing this? Have they given up? Do they recognize that this is over, or was this just a vengeful thing?
Well, I don't know that we're in the minds of these brutal terrorists. Mm-hmm. They've been responsible for intentionally slaughtering, gunning down civilians as they've tried to leave Western Mosul in particular. It happened in Eastern Mosul as well. So they're not beyond fighting among civilians, and then in fact killing civilians who are just trying to flee to get to refugee areas to get out of the fighting. I can't really describe why they do it, but if you've seen, they're making no friends anywhere. Mm-hmm. They're attacking in Europe, in London. They're attacking even in Tehran, in Iran, and in the United States. They're claiming responsibility for inspiring terrorist attacks against American people. So it seems to be just part of the way they operate to try to wreak as much havoc and spread death everywhere they can.
Before leaving Iraq and moving over to Syria, do you have any update on possible timing in terms of wrapping up that situation in Mosul? Because as I understand it, there are just a few hundred fighters that are pretty much surrounded. One of your colleagues mentioned earlier last week that the fighters there have two options, surrender or die. Do you have any idea, or is, I know you don't do timetables, and if you did, you wouldn't tell us, but is there a general ballpark for finishing Iraq or the Mosul situation?
It's important to remember that our strategy and the way we've been proceeding against ISIS is what we call by, with, and through the indigenous forces. So in this case, that's Iraq, and the Iraqi security forces, the Iraqi forces are in the lead, and they're going to make a determination like that to some degree. That's a choice to say where they believe it's just clearance or mop-up operations. They've indicated, the Iraqis have, that they believe that Mosul will make that declaration in the next several days or a couple of weeks at the most. What we're interested in is they are completely surrounded, and we are there to fully support with mostly airstrikes, but also we have advisors as close as we need to help them through that and navigating the very difficult ground that is trying to preserve the city as much as possible, certainly trying to preserve the lives and protect the lives of the civilians. And at the same time, this is an enemy that's been entrenched there for 2.5 years or more. They have booby traps. They have what we call vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices. I don't know if you ever remember watching the A-Team, but some of their vehicles, they take a car, the chassis, and they put, it looks just like something out of a bad television show, where they put armor all over it and they put a suicide bomber in there. It's laden with explosives, and they drive it at the Iraqi security forces to try to do everything they can in really desperate move just to lay waste to anything in front of them. I think it seems that if they can't have the territory, they're going to make it as painful and as difficult as possible. It's a foe that we cannot trifle with. They are sophisticated and they are determined, and it's a hard fight. So it's taken longer than some people had anticipated, but I think for the right reasons, trying to preserve the city as much as possible, trying to preserve the lives of the civilians who are still living there and will come back and reoccupy it once it's liberated.
Colonel, I've been told that a lot of the Yemen, a lot of the fighters in Syria, foreign and local, if you will, certainly the senior leadership of the Islamic State group, you've seen them leave, and the fighters that are left there are pretty far down the totem pole in terms of how they rank in the organization. Is that a fair assessment?
We know that foreign fighters were flowing into this region that they were calling their caliphate for a good number, a couple of years. And we've really worked hard with a whole of government approach with our partner nations and the nations that border that area to stop the flow of foreign fighters. There is a difference with foreign fighters coming from other countries, coming sometimes from the United States, coming from other Arab countries or European countries or African countries. They are different because they are there a lot of times to fight to the death. The people, the ISIS members who live in that region, they may have families with them. And what they tend to do is they tend to flee those areas when they've given up. They don't tell us when that's happening, right? But we track them, we watch them, and they will get among their family members. They'll make it very visible from above in case we have an unmanned system above watching, and they'll hide among them so that or make it very clear that if we bomb them, we would be harming civilians. And they flee because they have family, they have assets, they have reason to move on to another place. The foreign fighters have already left their families, they've already left their nations, and they often seem to leave them behind to fight to the death. So it's an unequal situation where the ones who recruit them are not really willing to die and for the ground that they're trying to keep, but the ones who are recruited are left there to fight, and they are sort of the ones who have nothing to lose, and they fight to the end. So we do see that dynamic.
Moving to Syria, Colonel, that's very complicated. Not that Iraq isn't complicated, but if Iraq is complicated, Syria is much more complicated because of those that are involved. You have the Syrians, the Russians, and the Iranians, and others that are engaged, they say, against the Islamic State. But at the same time, there's lots of evidence that they're really engaged against Syrian democratic forces. And recently, we've seen evidence of Syria essentially dispatching fighters, fighter jets, and drones to attack some of those U.S.-supported forces there. How has that gone in the last few weeks or so? Bring us up to speed, at least certainly in the last week or so. There have been a couple of high-profile incidents. Can you tell us about them?
It is a very complicated and complex battle space in Syria. We have Turkey, our NATO ally, has interests. They're a border nation. Jordan, an ally, is a border nation. And Iraq, an ally, is a border nation. And then the Russians, like you say, are flying there. The Russians work very closely with the Syrian regime. And then there are all these different militias and different interests. You mentioned the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is a collection of militias that are well led by Kurdish elements, but they are also significantly an Arab force now. They're recruiting as many people as they can on the ground. So there's what's going on the ground is one thing, moving toward Raqqa, surrounding the city of Raqqa to liberate it, to flush out the ISIS troops. That's all happening mostly in the mid to eastern half of Syria. The western half of Syria, Assad still controls most of those along the coast, most of those cities, but he doesn't control the rest of his country. It's an ungoverned space, and there's more than 50 members of the coalition against ISIS across the world, 50 different nations, 52, I think it is today, who are in agreement that we need to do everything we can, and they are contributing resources to go after ISIS. At the same time, there is that civil war going on between ISIS, and there's elements of Al-Qaeda, there's elements of Iranian regime, all happening, and then all those border conflicts with Turkey and Jordan and Iraq. So you rightfully describe it as a complicated area. What we've tried to do with the Russians, and therefore the Syrians, because we do not have diplomatic relations with the Syrians, we talk to the Russians on a telephone line, and we call it the deconfliction line. We don't coordinate or cooperate with the Russians. But if they're going to be flying somewhere, they tell us. If we're going to be operating somewhere, we tell them, so that we don't have we're not in each other's way, and we don't have aircraft flying in the same space and having safety of flight issues. We do count on the Russians to pass messages to the Syrian regime forces and vice versa if needed through that telephone line. And it's worked fairly well. Sometimes the Syrian regime forces have been confused or have not paid attention to where they are, where they're operating, or perhaps they're trying to be provocative we don't really care at that point. The one thing that is clear is if our forces, including our partner forces, are threatened in what is called collective self-defense, we will respond, we'll shoot down those aircraft, or we will respond on the ground if they are looking to attack the Syrian Democratic Forces, the vetted Syrian opposition forces, or certainly U.S. or coalition forces.
That deconfliction line you mentioned, the Russians, after these last events, certainly after the fighter shoot down, threatened to cut it off, cut off contact. Did that happen?
So it has led to, I think, tense situation in Syria with our Turkish allies and then with the Russians as well, as different nations have interests there that are sometimes in conflict. We're really trying to focus everybody on defeating ISIS first. Once ISIS is cleared from the area, then there's a chance for diplomacy to work. Then there's a chance for the humanitarian efforts to get back underway and return these cities and this region to more freedom-loving people rather than the terrorists that are ISIS. In general, everybody agrees that deconfliction line was set up for that purpose. The Russians decided that they wanted to go in and they wanted to attack ISIS. Okay. We said that's okay, but we need to make sure that we are working not at cross purposes, where we are not going to harm each other or lead to some escalation beyond that. That deconfliction line has remained up and running despite, I think, some tense moments where some things have been said publicly at a diplomatic and political level. We certainly take all those concerns seriously. We focus on the what we call the military to military, sort of a service member to service member on the Russian side. Is someone going to be there to pick up the phone and answer the phone to talk about, to say where we're going to be operating? And that has gone on through all these perturbations back and forth over the months. And it's really proved quite valuable. It continues even to today. We never know if they're going to pick up the phone tomorrow, but we go day to day on that.
So just to be clear and to just wrap that up, they never, within the last week or so after that threat, they never abandoned this deconfliction line.
We had it up, and there are some scheduled calls, and then there are calls as necessary. We never stopped literally sitting by that phone and listening if it was going to call. They have made all of their scheduled times that they call per week, and each time that we've been operating in that area, they've also picked up the phone to be there for when we're going to tell them. So far, it looks like it's continued as it had in the past.
The situation with the drone was, you mentioned that sometimes the Syrians go off the reservation. It's my understanding that there is an agreement that the Syrians have made with the Syrian Democratic Forces and I think the vetted forces that they would not go into certain areas, and they violated that with maybe the drone and the fighter jet. I'm not sure, but perhaps you can square us away on that. But is it your sense that that situation with the drone was deliberate in one of those situations where they decided, regardless of whatever agreements they had, that they were going to do that?
So a couple of things, because it is so complex, the fighter jet, the Su-22, was a Syrian regime aircraft with a Syrian regime pilot in it. The what you call a drone, that we call it unmanned aerial vehicle, was Iranian made, and we're not positive who was controlling it. You can control one of those unmanned vehicles from just about anywhere in the world. If you have connectivity, you sit there with a joystick and you can fly that thing. Mm-hmm. So we're not positive exactly who was at the controls. We've had two of those different incidents. What we are sure of is we could see it. We can see on these drones, we could see armaments hanging from the wings. So they were armed. They weren't just reconnaissance. And in one case, they fired, and it happened to be a dud. It did not explode, but it got awfully close, and we shot that one down. The second one was flying, ignoring all kind of rules of the road in the air there, where it was warned off by various means that are standard international protocols to indicate to the person who is flying it whether they're in the vehicle or not, whether they're in the aircraft or not. They can see what we're doing. They should be able to hear the radio calls. And here's what's important, JJ, is it doesn't matter particularly where they're flying. It's when they are presenting themselves as hostile intent and flying over or near or directly at where our forces or our partner forces is. So there are no lines in the sand that they can't cross. there is, it's very clear to them, though, and we've made it clear through the Russians, telling the regime forces and telling anyone who might fly there, and we say it publicly all the time, if you present yourself as hostile, if you're trying to fire upon, or you come with an armed aerial vehicle trying to fly over U.S. or partner or coalition forces, we will take action before you have a chance to fire us. And that's invoking the legal principle of collective self-defense.
As you look at the episodes that have taken place within the last week or so, the Su-22 and then the Shahed drone, does that suggest or appear to be an escalation by the Syrians or whomever? And does that give you any sense of desperation on their part?
Well, it is an escalation. And what we try to do in each of those cases is we try to what we call de-escalate. So we don't want anything to lead to anything that really distracts us from going against ISIS. So we would like the regime to allow us and allow the coalition to fight ISIS. If it's distracting from that, or it might lead to a direct confrontation between us and the Syrian regime, or us and the Russians, that's not good. Or us and or Syrian Democratic Forces and the Turks. None of these things would be good. We really want to focus them on there. So yes, these are provocative sometimes. They are escalatory in some cases. And what we try to do is take decisive action in self-defense, but then we try to keep all the lines of communication open. We do not want distractions from going after ISIS. And the Syrian government, the Assad regime, has been in the throes of a civil war for quite some time, years. And we don't take a side in that. We're not involved in the civil war. It sounds crazy, but we're not taking sides. We're operating in that country, but we are going after ISIS only, and then we hope to withdraw as rapidly as possible to defeat ISIS, and then let the Syrian question be resolved by other matters.
One of the key elements of the week of June 12th, 2017, one of the big stories has been a report from Russia that it had reason to believe that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi may have been killed in an airstrike on May 28th in and around Raqqa, may have been in an assembly with lots of other people, a large number of people. At some point, there were some estimations of maybe a couple hundred people. Later in the week, they came back and said they were still examining this situation. Is there any evidence that Central Command has seen that there was this large gathering or some type of airstrike of that magnitude, that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi may have been amongst that group?
Well, I'll leave it to the Russians to talk about what their intelligence is or what their facts are. We know that they put out video. They put out a lot of information about where they struck and what and who they thought they struck. Al-Baghdadi is a person that we wouldn't object to if he were taken off the battlefield. He's not a good guy and certainly not helpful to us. We don't cooperate and we don't coordinate with the Russians. So all we do is what is this kind of bureaucratic sounding word, deconflict. So we do know they tell us where they're going to be firing. They do know where we are going to be bombing. Other than that, we're not sharing intelligence. So I don't know what the Russians are seeing. We have no confirmation. We have no reason to believe that Baghdadi was struck by them. We might be surprised. That can always change. But we have no independent confirmation and no reason to think that is or isn't true. We'll just leave it up to the Russians. We're certainly not seeing that ourselves.
What is Central Command able to say in regards to, independent of that, Baghdadi's status?
Well, he's someone that we would like to see removed. He has been successful in hiding. He's been successful in most likely moving from place to place, and we do have folks who are dedicated to trying to track his and other high value targets' whereabouts. But it's not the cause that we're going after is one particular person. We're trying to first deny this so-called physical caliphate to ISIS and to stop the flow of foreign fighters liberate the cities, return the control of the areas to the indigenous people. And there's a larger, I think, battle of wills and ideologies that is beyond, to some degree, the military. But we're really trying to, there are hundreds of thousands, millions of people through these different cities as we've marched along, retaking the ground, retaking the cities that ISIS took, that we are quite honestly happy to liberate. They are under dramatic oppression and from people who care nothing about human lives other than their own. And that's really the focus. So any particular player, if we can complicate it for them, if we can make it harder for ISIS to exist, to spread their hateful ideology, if we can make it harder for them to communicate across the internet, we absolutely do that. Individuals are not the prize. The prize is liberating and returning to local rule these areas that they've taken, and then also trying to interrupt their development and export of foreign plots in the Western world, in Europe, in the United States, and even as we saw in Tehran. That's really the goal.
Listening to what you're saying, it's pretty clear that the destruction of the larger organization is the goal. Do you think the organization would be much different without Baghdadi around?
Well, every organization has its leader, and one of the things we've tried to do is make it very difficult for him or for other leaders of ISIS to even communicate to the outside world. There's been a dramatic drop off in those horrific videos that some people have gotten unfortunately accustomed to seeing, of people being executed on internet video, or of these speeches given rallying people to come into the area. That's not without some purpose. You see less of that because even in the cyber domain, I think that the whole of government approach of the United States and these 52 coalition nations has tried to make it so we take his and others' voices away. Certainly a movement like this does have dynamic leaders that rally people. Like I said, they are a viable foe, and we do take them seriously. But no movement hinges on just one person. Those foreign fighters and those inspired attacks, those folks who say that they are inspired across the internet, across the world, to this cause of you know, brutal hatred and killing innocent people, that's a different ideology that has caught on. And we really are working with the Europeans and what they call a counter ISIS coalition to kind of attack that at the source and try to discredit what they're saying and make sure that these youngsters who believe that they're going serving some patriotic cause, something that's serving their religion or serving freedom, we're trying to make it clear that it's not freedom at all. It's just brutal, an ideology of brutality and death. So is an individual person important? Certainly. But if we can take their voice away, whether or not they're alive, if we can take their credibility away, and if we can take the land that they conquered, that they took over, take it from them and deny that sham of a physical caliphate that goes across international borders. They said they were going to establish a new Muslim caliphate. We make that into a lie by taking those cities back and giving it back to the local population.
In the last couple of years, we have been, media and most of the world has been, obsessed with figuring out the situation with ISIS. And before that, Yemen was considered by many to be the most dangerous place in the world because of AQAP. What is the latest about Yemen that you can share with us?
The situation in Yemen isn't good, especially if you're one of the hundreds of thousands of people who are starving and who have been fighting a cholera epidemic and have been denied aid by the Houthi rebels who have taken over parts of that country. And like you say, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is also working out of Yemen. And their specialty, their niche, is exporting terrorist plots. From Yemen, they hatch these plans, and then through the internet and other means, they get them out. So the government that we recognize in Yemen is in exile. And it's not a good situation. The neighbor partner and neighbor countries on the tip of the Arabian Peninsula there, they are engaging as best they can. Saudi Arabia is working to defend its borders. And what's also important in addition to it being a hub of exporting terrorism in Yemen and this terrible humanitarian crisis that the country is facing, is on either side of the tip of the Arabian Peninsula, you have the Straits of Hormuz, and you have what's called the Bab el-Mandeb, a very narrow strait that leads from the Red Sea out, so that's access to and from the Suez Canal. So we're really looking to contain and control this ungoverned state that's called Yemen, so that it doesn't spill out into the ocean, so that it doesn't threaten freedom of navigation and freedom to operate of commerce to flow through the region. The world's oil, large portions of the world's oil and energy reserves flow through those two straits on either tip of the side of the Arabian Peninsula. So Yemen is not a good situation. We also in Yemen, similar to Syria, are not taking sides in the civil war. We are conducting anti-Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula efforts to try to stop Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And we're trying to help, to some degree, Saudi Arabia maintain its border. But that civil war needs diplomats and needs the world to pay attention to it and try to get aid to those people.
How large is the force that's in Yemen, or at least engaged with Yemen?
From the coalition side?
Yes, sir.
Very small. We're leveraging very small teams to try to have a significant impact. We have conducted more than 80 airstrikes in Yemen just this year alone. So it's active. And there's some cases where we've been on the ground. And what we're trying to do is understand better how this network works in Yemen, trying to understand the enemy better, trying to figure out how they operate so that we can disrupt it and we can stop it. But you're talking very, very small numbers and teams that do not spend more than some number of days in Yemen and then exit again. It's special operations. There's no conventional U.S. or coalition forces in there. And just like through this, I mentioned before, the buy with and through strategy is to try to work indigenous population to take care of their own problem. We have unique assets like air power. We can refuel planes in the air. We can fly great distances. We can bring combat power and logistical support and food and different things that other nations can't. So that's how we enable them. But the folks on the ground, we're hoping we can make them better to take care of themselves. But in Yemen, going after Al-Qaeda, you'll hear occasionally news that we've struck. Just this past week, we announced we're striking targets. We're striking people to try to disrupt that particular nexus of terror that does spend its time trying to export terror plots around the world.
So Yemen and Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, do you get the sense that they're still able to produce and engage terrorist plots and technology and all of the things they were known for, specifically because of Ibrahim al-Assiri and his bomb-making expertise? Are they still able to engage on the level that they were several years ago, which was fairly high?
They are still engaging in that, but much less so. So those airstrikes that I talked about, more than 80 just this year alone, and the intelligence efforts that we focused and the special operations efforts we focused on them is really helping us understand and therefore disrupt who they are, how they operate, how they communicate internally and also to the external world. So we've had a significant impact on them, but they are still a viable foe that we take very seriously, and we're not gonna stop until we've disrupted and made it so that they are unable to export terror from Yemen.
Afghanistan, critical right now. What can you tell us about that situation?
So Afghanistan is also in our what we call area of responsibility. It is unfortunately, and I want to make sure I mention it here because it's unfortunately the forgotten conflict going on. And we still have, and the international community still has an operation called Resolute Support there. And there's also a counterterrorism aspect to what we're doing in Afghanistan against the Taliban, but also Al-Qaeda. And more recently and troubling is an organization called Islamic State Khuristan, ISK. So an ISIS offshoot. In Afghanistan. That's been going on for 15 or 16 years in Afghanistan, and a lot of people forget that we're even still there. We don't forget it, and we're working every day to try to make not only the capital safe, but Kabul in Afghanistan. But really, we want to, and I think we're making progress toward building up the Afghan national government's ability to police its own cities, build a national police force, build local police forces, and also to fight against the Taliban. And it's a very complicated region because of the Pakistan as a border nation, and the the terrorists, the Taliban as well, flow back and forth across a rather porous border in very, very tough terrain. And so you've heard words like Tora Bora 15, 16 years ago, and just in the last couple of weeks. The fight goes on, and what we're really trying to do is make the Afghans more capable of working these insurgent issues on their own. And that's going to still take some time, but we're working to train, advise, and assist them and move them forward. It's not easy, but we're in it for the long haul.
Is there any news about troop levels there?
So no, not yet. I think we're happy to see is I think the administration is taking a big picture time to get the policy right and to decide what we want to do going forward after a decade and a half of fighting and building the Afghan government. Trying to get it right. I think you've seen recently the president delegated to the Secretary of Defense specific decisions about the number of troops. That'll make things easier once that policy is decided, a little bit more agile, a little bit faster, so that we can get troops where we need them. And it's important to know there's an anti-ISIS fight in Afghanistan. There's an anti-Al-Qaeda fight in Afghanistan. And then there's an anti-Taliban effort to build the Afghan national government. So the European, the coalition, the larger world coalition, they have a large part in the train, advise, and assist. It might be some extra U.S. forces can go in and more dramatically affect the fight against ISIS and the fight against Al-Qaeda in that anti-terrorism role. So that'll be announced, I think they've said, in the coming weeks what those numbers are going to be. It's not going to be a dramatic increase from everything we're hearing, but it will be some number of a few thousand or so, perhaps, extra troops to go in and try to make a difference there to stop ISIS from establishing a foothold in Afghanistan.
Well, Colonel Thomas, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. Thank you for doing this. Hopefully we can re-engage again and do this fairly regularly.
I look forward to it, JJ.
That's it for this episode. Coming up on our next program, whether it's terrorism, anarchists, cyber criminals, nation states, intelligence, or the U.S.'s own counterintelligence drama that's playing out in the Congress. Join us on Target USA for the latest. Thank you for checking in with us. Follow us on Twitter at TUSA Podcast. That's Tango Uniform Sierra Alpha Podcast. You can also let me know what you think at jgreen@wtop.com. That's the letter J, the color green, one word, at Whiskey Tango Oscar Papa, jgreen@wtop.com. I'm JJ Green, and this is Target USA.
The National Security Podcast.